This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Donors, sponsors, and musicians who made Once in a Boom Moon a huge success. It was absolutely an amazing evening, and we are very, very grateful. Plans are already underway for next year's event. The Spring Drive is coming up March 21st through April 6th. We have some great specials planned for this membership drive. And we have designed a brand new limited edition t-shirt that will only be available during the membership drive. Details about this shirt will be coming soon. And don't forget, if you would like to participate in the special social media SWAT team, we are meeting Sunday, March 3rd, 1 p.m. at the KBOO Studios. If you would like more information, or you can't come and you would still like to participate, then please email Lynn Fitch, navigator at kboo.org. Thank you.
PDX Fusion creates events that celebrate different modalities of expression and community building. Friday, March 1st, KBOO Radio is proud to help PDX Fusion in sponsoring a night themed around dreams at the Refuge, 116 Southeast Yamhill. The night begins with a lecture entitled The Art of Dreaming, which will include visual representations of dream theory, demonstrate practical work in our relationships, as well as give the audience a brief opportunity to explore inner work. That's Fusion Dreams at 116 Southeast Yamhill. This is a 21 and over event on Friday, March 1st at 8 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/dreams2013.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, legislation for single-payer health care is introduced in the Oregon House.
Construction of a controversial development project in Southeast Portland is put on hold.
Local residents and anti-nuclear activists continue their warnings regarding the hazardous conditions at Hanford.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, March 1st, 2013. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. New development along transit corridors in Southeast Portland hit a rare speed bump when the Oregon Land Use Board of Appeals halted construction on an 81-unit apartment project. The developer had continued work all during the appeal. The building now stands half-finished at Southeast 37th and Division. KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with neighborhood activist Judah Gold-Markle for the story.
The Richmond neighborhood won a rare LUBA appeal when the state court halted construction on 81 new apartments without parking at 37th and Division in Southeast Portland. The recent surge of construction along so-called transit routes such as Belmont, Hawthorne, and Division have left many Southeast neighbors feeling left out of the discussion. I spoke with neighborhood activist Judah Gold-Markle for details.
So Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth is a community organization that was grown out of the concern over the building at 37th and Division, the apartment building, and the lack of communication by the developer, Dennis Sackhoff. There was a lot of concerns over various issues, including the one that galvanized a lot of people, which was 81 apartment units being built without any additional parking. And then also there was a lot of concerns over the total number of apartments and the cumulative effect that it is having with other large apartment buildings going in, and then furthermore, also the design of the apartment building as it was basically a big dormitory-style apartment building. So this led to Richmond Neighbors for Responsible Growth trying to come and sit at the table with the developer, which he refused to do. So we were forced to go down a legal strategy and a legal pathway, and we took his design plans to LUBA, which is the Land Use Board of Appeals. And at the Board of Appeals, we won on a narrow victory, and his permit was revoked and reversed. He chose to continue building even when he knew he was under risk during the LUBA appeal. And at this point, we have four unfinished stories of apartment building at 37th and Division, and he no longer has a permit for that.
What was the LUBA case based on?
The LUBA case was based on several things. There was three main points, or what we called errors. The first one was there wasn't proper notification to the neighborhood regarding such a big building being put in. The second one was on the height of the building and how it didn't have an appropriate step down with vis-a-vis its zoning code, because the lot itself was zoned in two ways. And then the third one was the entranceway and where it was in comparison to the commercial corridor, which was Division Street. We won the reversal of the permit due to the entranceway. Other two points were thrown out by the Land Use Board of Appeals.
Rebecca Esau said that the developer Urban Development Group doesn't have to make any changes.
That's not entirely true. They have to go back through the permitting process in its entirety. They still have to go through the public initiation process where they have to contact the neighborhood association. And we continue to advocate that there needs to be a fair way to include the community in how developers implement plans that affect the communities long term.
That was neighborhood activist Judah Gold-Merkel. His group is looking for a way to get developers to come to the table and advocates for projects that will benefit the neighborhood as well as the developer. Meanwhile, Buckman neighbors are looking for a voice at the development table through the creation of an historic district. For links to get involved and for the full interview with Judah Gold-Merkel, please go to the KABU website. And this is Joe Meyer with KABU News.
On Thursday, a 5-year-old girl by the name of Morgan Maynard Cook was traveling home from the house of a family friend with two other children when she was struck and killed by a car. The car that hit her was driven by 69-year-old Hwang Dong Bacon. Police stated that Bacon was cooperative, remained at the scene, and didn't appear to have been speeding. The mother of the 5-year-old girl, Connie Ruiz, says the accident could have been prevented with a crosswalk. The accident occurred at the intersection of Southeast 136th Avenue and Ellis Street. In June 2010, Ruiz's oldest daughter was struck in the same intersection, but she survived. Ruiz claims the intersection has no sidewalks or crosswalks, which makes the intersection dangerous for many children who live in the area. Cook had just started kindergarten at Gilbert Park Elementary School this year.
Six recently confirmed leaks of nuclear waste storage tanks have put the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in the spotlight. 2 weeks ago, the Department of Energy announced that one storage tank is leaking. A week later, Washington Governor Jay Inslee confirmed that there are six leaking tanks. Though Governor Inslee said that there is no immediate risk to public health, environmental groups and area residents are concerned that the leaking radioactive waste could make its way into groundwater and eventually into the nearby Columbia River. Last Thursday, Columbia Riverkeeper, along with Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility and the Sierra Club, hosted an information session about the Columbia Generating Station and waste treatment at the Hanford site. Dan Searies, the conservation director of Columbia Riverkeeper, spoke about the leaking tanks.
So to summarize, there's 56 million gallons of high-level waste and 177 tanks in the Hanford site. The tanks are very old. There's 68 known leakers. That's before this week when they announced that there's six more. And some of this waste has already reached groundwater. The oldest tank, 68 years old, the newest tank, 26 years, and they've already discovered that even the double shell tanks are beginning to fail. So what's the solution? The idea was to take this liquid waste and turn it into glass logs. That facility, which is called the Waste Treatment or Vitrification Plant, is over budget, behind schedule, and is facing such huge technical hurdles that literally engineers are stepping away from the project and becoming whistleblowers and saying, this facility really might not work.
The newly discovered leaks have also put a spotlight on Hanford's Columbia Generating Station, the Pacific Northwest's only operating nuclear reactor. Also speaking at last Thursday's information session was Paul Gunter, an expert on nuclear issues and the director of Beyond Nuclear's Reactor Oversight Project. While discussing the potential consequences of continuing to operate this nuclear power plant, Gunter noted several similarities between the Hanford reactor and the failed reactors at Fukushima, Japan.
The overarching concern is that we don't really have a regulatory atmosphere for this, that our regulators, the federal government, have pretty much always been captured by the nuclear corporations, again, which share this goal of nuclear weapons and nuclear power. And so at the root of our problem and the root of our talk tonight is this issue of nuclear regulatory capture. Central to this issue and our concern today is the advent of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident, which again was another clear warning that nuclear power is inherently dangerous. And on March 11th, 2011, I was invited into CNN studios in Washington, D.C. to respond to this nuclear disaster that was evolving following the earthquake and the tsunami off the eastern shore of Japan. And the journalist, Jean Meserve, Jean asked me, she said, look, just in the simplest terms, tell us what your concern is about this reactor at Fukushima Daiichi. And I said, in the clip that went on to the Situation Room with Wolf Blitzer that afternoon, was our concern is that this reactor could literally blow its roof off. And of course, the next day, that's exactly what happened at Unit 1. And my counterpart to this interview, Tony Petranglio, with the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the chief lobby group there in Washington, and basically represents all of the nuclear power corporations in the United States, said, well, that's very, very, very remote. There's no indication right now that there's any trouble with the containment at the Fukushima plants. And, it stands as a contrast that we constantly hear this issue that the probability is so remote that it need not be anybody's concern.
That was Paul Gunter, an expert on nuclear issues, speaking at an information session highlighting the concerns surrounding nuclear power and the problems at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. On tonight's show, we'll hear about the role of the North Portland Library in telling the history of African Americans in Portland. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather shows patchy fog in the morning with afternoon rain and a high of near 56.
It's 5:16, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
While we sports fans regularly lionize the stars of pro baseball, football, basketball, etc., it's time to acknowledge that the team executives and owners also are great sports, and they routinely make dazzling off-the-field moves. The Miami Herald recently spotlighted one such star up in the owner's box at the Miami Dolphins football stadium. Team CEO Mike D was asked in a TV interview whether a nearly $200 million taxpayer subsidy proposed for the team's privately owned stadium is welfare for billionaires. Rather than trying an end run around the obvious point that the owners ought to pay for their own stadium, Dee plowed straight ahead, running like a Hall of Fame fullback right up the middle of the question. Rich people, he explained, should not invest money in a way that is unwise. What a sporting fellow! Just toss the unwise investment to taxpayers. Let them fumble it. Herald writer Glenn Garvin notes that the Carolina Panthers ran an $80 million pass play at Charlotte's city officials to refurbish the stadium the team owns. When those local defenders of taxpayers' money offered little resistance, the Panthers quickly called an audible, going long for a Hail Mary pass of $125 million in subsidies. Then, owner Jerry Richardson was brought in to face a closed-door meeting with the city council. It looked bad for the team at first, but Jerry turned it around with some deft inside maneuvers, sprinting out of the meeting with a total score of nearly $144 million in public funds. This is Jim Hightower saying, all across the country, from Tampa Bay to San Francisco Bay, these corporate laterals and quarterback sneaks are ripping off taxpayers for billions of dollars, money that should go to public needs, not private profits. To check out the game in your area, go to www.fieldofschemes.com. Fieldofschemes.com. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
There are two bills in the Oregon House that could lead to single-payer health care in Oregon. While other developed countries have single-payer health care, in the United States, only Vermont has a comparable system. For more details on the single-payer efforts in Oregon, KBOO's Rebecca Ney spoke with Camilla Marquez of Jobs with Justice and Healthcare for All Oregon.
Right now, we have two bills that have been presented. HB 2922 is an act for affordable health care for all Oregon. And HB 3260 is a bill to obtain finance for a study of how this act should be financed. The legislation for the bill, an act for affordable health care for all Oregon, is a bill which would provide a way of supporting payments for all health care delivered through hospitals, through clinics, through private doctors, through the agency of the government, which would collect taxes and use those dedicated taxes to pay the bills that people charge for health care. It would provide health care to everyone. No one would be left out. Prior conditions, employment, unemployment, everyone will be covered. It will be much simplified in terms of the administration. There won't be the kind of fragmentation of healthcare systems that you have now. It will accommodate or incorporate the Oregon health transition with the CCOs.
What's the current status of this proposed legislation? Who are your supporters, and how likely is it that this will get pushed through?
The bill is presently in the Healthcare Committee of the House. Hearings are scheduled for sometime the end of the month, so the hearings will have to be held, and what Healthcare for All Oregon is doing now is organizing to present testimony at the hearings to bring as many of the constituencies that it represents to ask the legislators to support it. There's no question that this is going to be opposed by the insurance lobby. What the chances are, I think it remains to be seen how well our case is developed. But what I think is really important is that when we have the study completed, what the study can potentially demonstrate is huge budget savings. You know that all your health care is going to be covered by this program. That means governments, businesses, institutions no longer have to cover health care expenses. That's going to be a huge saving. Can you imagine all the people who are concerned about the local budgets with health care, fire, all the public services that essentially are compromised because of increasing health care costs will no longer have to worry. There's going to be a huge windfall, and we can predict that it will probably cost no more to cover everyone, all the people who are unemployed, who have no health care, will be covered without an increase in the total amount that we spend on health care now.
Tens of billions of dollars in automatic spending cuts begin to go into effect today as part of the so-called sequester triggered by last year's Budget Control Act. Most government programs will be affected, from education to bridge repair to food assistance to the military. Following a Friday morning meeting today at the White House with Republican and Democratic congressional leaders that produced no results, President Obama told reporters he would keep pushing for a bill to undo the cuts over the coming weeks. Two last-minute Senate bills to alter the sequester failed yesterday. The Democratic-backed bill would have raised revenue through the so-called Buffett rule, which raises taxes on people making more than $1 million a year. It also cut back on direct cash subsidies to farmers. The Republican bill, which also failed, would have given the military, but not domestic agencies, more flexibility in where to cut spending. Senate Democrats also introduced a bill this week to levy a 0.03% tax on Wall Street transactions, which could raise hundreds of billions of dollars within a decade. Yet even as party leaders scramble to address the sequester, potentially bigger budget woes are on the horizon. If Congress can't pass a budget or a continuation of last year's budget by the end of the month, the government will run out of funding.
One of the largest freshwater lakes in Africa, Lake Chad, is at risk of disappearing in the coming decades. Scientists have tracked its diminishing size, finding it shrunk by 95% over 35 years. Regional leaders say they have a new solution, diverting water from the Ubangi River in the Congo to Lake Chad. But the project will be costly, and some environmentalists say it could bring new consequences for river and lake communities. FSRN's Anjala Killian Chimtum reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
On the banks of Lake Chad, Muhammad Abubakar disentangles a tiny black catfish from a large net.
Before, you needed to cast the net just a few times to catch thousands of fish, but today it may require a whole day's job to get this.
The paltry catch, which is worth just about $2, is likely to be his only income for the day. The 64-year-old fisherman says back when the lake was healthy and teeming with life, he could earn as much as $50 each day. His smaller catch has coincided with Lake Chad's diminishing size.
Survival has become a real problem here because we don't have any other means of livelihood.
Bordered by Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria, Lake Chad once spanned 10,000 square miles. It's currently about 1,000 square miles. The once lush region is now filled with dusty air, fierce and unrelenting winds, wilting plants, and sand dunes. As a result of feeble rainfall, the Shari and Logone, the two main rivers that feed the lake, are bringing less and less water each year. Herders, fisherfolk, and farmers who have relied for generations on the rich soil of this basin are now struggling to survive as the lake dries up before their very eyes. Sanusi Irman Abdullahi is executive director of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, a regional body created by the countries bordering the lake with the aim of regulating water use and other natural resources in the basin. He says the shrinking of the lake is a disaster, noting that it has taken its toll on local residents.
40 years ago, the population within the Lake Chad area was about 17 million. Now we have about 30 million plus. So you can see there is demand by the human population, increase in animal consumption, of course, and then massive evaporation as a result of climate change.
Experts say it's impossible to blame the crisis on one single factor. Environmentalist Augustine Jamshi, the Central African representative of the Pan-African Climate Alliance, says climate change, population growth, and poor conservation are part of the problem.
It has to do with the agricultural practices, that the way people are using the water. But I think climate change is also to be blamed for the disappearance of Lake Chad.
Jamshi says water from Cameroon's Shari River and its tributary the Logone provides over 90% of Lake Chad's water, but is being diverted by local farmers to irrigation projects in the surrounding area. Others, including the Commission's Abdullahi, said dams built along the Jamari and Hadejia rivers in northeastern Nigeria are partly responsible for the shrinkage. In an effort to replenish the water body, the Lake Chad Basin Commission wants to use water from the Obangi, a tributary of the Congo River. Abdullahi says this plan won't cause water problems for the Congo.
There's so much water in the Congo that goes into the ocean. We are just going to take a fraction of it to save the lives of over 30 million people.
Abdullahi further says the project will involve the construction of a retention dam in the Central African Republic. The water would then be channeled to the Shari River in Cameroon through a more than 800-mile-long canal before flowing naturally into Lake Chad. He says this project would bring other benefits, expanding the electricity supply, ensuring river transportation, and aiding irrigation and agroforestry in the region.
So the program is not only to bring water to Lake Chad, but also to improve the economic activity and the livelihood of the people within the Congo Basin.
The effort still needs funding. It's projected to cost about $14.5 billion. There are also critics, including Eric Bizil, with the Yaoundé-based Center for the Environment and Development.
We will have as environmental impact the destruction of the forest, which will lead to biodiversity loss. Plants will also be lost, some of which are totally protected. We will also see animals losing their habitat. As concerned humans, we are going to see the destruction of farmlands and settlements, as well as sacred sites, because these are areas inhabited by indigenous peoples who carry out traditional rites.
For the time being, farmers and fisherfolk are showing resilience, adapting as best they can to the looming crisis. Amadou Bello, a fisherman in Golfe, has simply turned to farming, producing such crops as cowpea, maize, rice and peppers without using fertilizers. Showing off his thriving farm with a wave of his hand, he says the disappearing lake has left behind very fertile land.
It's quite amazing. I couldn't imagine that we could live on any other resource apart from the lake. But just look at the way these crops are blossoming.
But if the lake does not return, even the remaining humidity left by its receding waters will evaporate, and both farmers and fishermen will be left with few options for a livelihood. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Quinn Reed, Joe Meyer, and Karen Kinnison. The producer is Rebecca Ney. Our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. Special thanks to the reporters from Free Speech Radio News. Their daily broadcast can be found at the website at fsrn.org. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K264AA Corvallis, 100.7 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterland.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Celeste Carey and Cecil Prescott speak with Erica Chenoweth, co-author with Maria Stephan of Why Civil Resistance Works, The Strategic Logic of Nonviolent Conflict. At 9 on the Old Mole Variety Hour, Bill Resnick talks with Stephen Hellman about Italian politics. Denise Morris explains why poverty is a queer gay issue, particularly in light of the right-wing embrace of gay marriage. Well-read Red Fran Michelle reflects on recent controversies concerning voting rights, and Ivan Hale shares comments on community mental illness. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Locus Focus, a weekly interview show about our place on the planet with Barbara Bernstein. At 11 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman interviews Dr. Victoria Mazes, an expert on women's health and executive director of the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine. She'll talk about her book on maximizing fertility and giving birth to a healthy child. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio, voices and divisions from outside mental health with Will Hall. His guest is David Cohen. Thank you, KBOO members, for supporting your community radio station. If you're not currently a KBOO member, you can go to kboo.fm and click donate. Now stay tuned for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight on Bread and Roses, the role of the North Portland Library in telling the history of African Americans in Portland. Have a great weekend. Good night, Linda.
Good night, Liam.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, controversy surrounded the movie Zero Dark Thirty, which many felt distorted the efficacy of CIA torture. But what about the movie that won the Academy Award, Argo, based on the true story of the Iranian hostage crisis? Just how far removed is it from that true story, and why does it matter? We'll hear from Nima Shirazi of the blog Wide Asleep in America about his piece, Oscar Prince the Legend. Also on the show, the Supreme Court has determined that the government doesn't have to reveal who it's targeting with its domestic spying programs. But civil liberties groups can't challenge the spying because